I'm Rich. That's Greg, by the way. Thank you all for coming. This is fantastic. Thank you. Hey, Greg Gutfeld, everybody.
I'm not going to thank you because I should expect you to be here. I expect nothing less. And she's in the trunk. She should, hopefully the sedatives won't kick in for a while. Or they might wear off. Who knows?
We might take away your temple degree if you keep making jokes like that.
No, temple degree?
It was a Cosby reference. So we're not going to make any politically incorrect jokes tonight because that's off limits, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Everything should be very serious and solemn. I'd like to talk about the environment. What we are doing to the environment is disgusting. You should be ashamed of yourselves. All of you people. I'm sure you all drove here in cars. Oh. Yes. There you go. So, questions? You were supposed to interview me. Are you just going to sit there with that funny microphone?
Yeah, why is my microphone orange?
I don't know. It's just a very odd kind of weird mutant pumpkin.
I was hoping to have a sort of a blue microphone. You could have the red one. We could do kind of a crosstalk sort of a thing.
Yeah, that could work.
On the five, you used to have Bob Beckel. He's gone.
Right.
So you guys, don't do that.
I love Bob. Love Bob.
But we're glad he's gone. But now that he's gone.
Oh, come on.
And you've got a lot of good co-hosts on that. But also there's the Greg Gutfeld show. Who watches the Greg Gutfeld show? Right?
Yes.
Now,
I like to call it the one. Because that's originally, that was the original name of the five, was the one. But I said, no, you could have four other people join me. And so that's what they did.
You lived in Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Absolutely.
And
anybody
you also,
from Allentown?
Allentown? Anybody?
the sign if you're from Allentown is that you don't clap. I love Allentown, actually.
And Greg has a South Jersey connection with Cherry Hill and the Cherry Hill Mall.
Yeah.
He went to, he took a class down there.
Yes, I did. And it had nothing to do with probation. When I was working at Men's Health in the late 90s, I was also on doing a thing for Good Morning America, like a men's kind of segment, and I went to Santa school. And I think it was Cherry Hill, the Cherry Hill Mall, where I went to Santa school and learned to be a Santa. The first day I violated the main rule. The interesting thing about these Santas is that their beards are real and their weight is real. These are the real Santa guys, and they're all bikers because only bikers have those kinds of beards and those kinds of bellies and that kind of salty language. The stuff these guys say. Anyway, long story short was I went there. I broke the cardinal rule. I had a drink at a bar in the mall, and these guys were really rough, but they hated me. They were really upset because I had a drink. You're not supposed to drink if you're Santa, apparently. But I thought Rudolph had a red nose, so. but the best, the story ended with me driving on. I went through the wrong toll booth on the way home that night, and I was in a hurry to get home. And so I did that thing where I'm going to go around. And I turned around, and I went back and I made it home and everything. And then like 2 months later or something, I get a letter from the city and a picture, because they take your picture, and there's this guy, blurry picture of this guy in a Santa outfit. I'm like going, oh, well, that's me. Cost me $200.
Do you consider yourself to be a hipster?
No. No, I don't.
Do you hate hipsters?
Not really. Some of my best friends are hipsters, but a hipster is somebody who's deliberately trying to be edgy, and I find that to be nauseating. I think that, like, actually interesting, edgy, uncompromising people, that happens naturally because they have I write about this in Not Cool. They have a code. Like people that, like Andrew Breitbart, somebody who has an internal code so that you kind of know what they're going to do or what they're going to think about because they're honest every day. They have that principle. The kind of people I hate are the opposite of people, opposite of that, the opportunist, the person who reacts to an event and then figures out what to do. I hate those people, as I like to say on the five. But no, I'm not a hipster. I don't dislike hipsters. I just don't like contrived people. you know, I guess that's it, right? I don't care.
Well, let's think about for a second. They say Stephen Colbert is now number 4 in the ratings at night.
Yeah.
And I find a lot of humor to be directed towards the smarter in the room crowd. You know, it's not about being funny anymore. It's about proving how smart you can be. And if people don't laugh, it's because they're just not bright enough to get the joke.
Yeah. But it's not just with humor. It's with everything. I mean, if you look at, like, House of Cards. I'm so sick of hearing people talk about that show because they didn't watch it. They just like say, oh yeah, I'm watching House of Cards. But they're really watching Scandal in their underwear. Let's face it. But it is true. It's like there's things that are kind of approvable laugh lines. You can make fun of Republicans. You can make fun of Republican women. You can make fun of pro-lifers. But you can't make fun of anything that is considered progressive because their hearts are in the right place. Let's face it. You know, if you're a right winger, you're evil. But if you're a liberal, you're just wrong. That's how we look at it. But they will assume you're evil, so you're fair game. They can say the worst things about you that they want, and then they make jokes. And then their jokes aren't even that funny, but it's because the jokes are approved. Everybody laughs. It's like, ah, ha, 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 that's a joke about Bush. You know, that everybody.
And if you don't laugh, then you're not part of the cool kids club.
Exactly. But, you know, I don't know. I just don't go to those places. I just stay home in a dark room and drink and listen to soft jazz.
Anybody here have to argue with their relatives at Christmas or Thanksgiving? That's kind of a mantra that's been shoved down our throats lately. You know, how to argue with your drunken Republican uncle at Thanksgiving. And now Harvard has their safe space, social justice warrior placemat. The reason why we wanted you here, and we love your book, How to Be Right, everybody's going to get a copy of it tonight, is you show us how to argue with people who inherently think we're evil.
Right.
And we are evil. I mean, we should say that for the record.
That's the first thing you should. It's like going to AA. You said, I'm Greg Gutfeld and I'm evil. And you guys go, hi, Greg Gutfeld. And then I tell you what I did that was evil. The whole point of the book, and it's about connecting dots, really. And the whole point of the book was people kept asking me how I write my monologues. And in the morning when I get up, I think of something that kind of ticks me off or just is an example of some kind of pretension or hypocrisy. And then I think about how can I persuade somebody in 80 seconds why my point is important and what the truth is. And the interest for me is brevity and clearness, clarity, not using any kind of jargon. I hate jargon. I hate catchphrases because catchphrases are basically ways not to think. So when I write my monologues, I make sure that none of that is present. And the only thing that's present is that one point where I'm trying to say, this is the truth. And as clearly as possible, about the connecting the dots point when you're talking about, let's say you are at a table and you've got your 21-year-old or 20-year-old daughter back from Harvard, and she's suddenly telling you that you are, you know, guilty of white male privilege or this or that. I talk about it in the book. The easiest thing you can do is just connecting the dots. That's all you do. And, you know, if somebody says you're guilty of white privilege, you go, okay, what's the solution? And they say, well, how is that going to happen? And you have to keep pushing them because what happens with a lot of the left is they never connect one dot. They stop at the first dot. They just say, white people have been extremely evil for the white people. So what are we going to do about it? Are you, and this is to steal from Dinesh D'Souza, you know, when a student says, how do you feel about being a recipient of white male privilege? And he goes, well, before, you know, Dinesh D'Souza made a great point. Before you lecture me, I want you to give up your spot at Amherst College for somebody else. Because if you aren't going to act on your own white privilege, you aren't telling anybody else. And that's what you say. If a student brings that up, you just go, okay, then you should no longer go to Harvard or Yale. You should make a spot available for somebody else. And they go, well, no. And they go, well, then what are you doing to help people? You're just you're pathetic. But that's a Dinesh D'Souza line, and it's a really good one, and it's a great way to connect the dots. Almost every liberal idea connects no dots, because if you did, it would no longer be an idea. I mean, I do this in the book. A perfect example is after Benghazi, which I know people are tired of hearing about, but I will never get tired of talking about it, when Hillary blamed it on a video. And I should have started with that.
Wait, are you saying it was not about a video?
No,
you're saying that.
But here's the thing.
Is that news? Do we know that?
Yeah. Right. But I want to show you how, by connecting the dots, you can utterly destroy Hillary Clinton so that she shouldn't even run a Waffle House, not the White House. She should be in the Big House. She treats national security the way her husband treats a cigar. Oh, stop it. Grow up. Anyway, that's a Joan Rivers line. Anyway, so I do this whenever I get into a conversation about a video caused Benghazi. Okay, so that's the argument that President Obama pushed. That's the argument that Hillary Clinton pushed. It's an argument that should have them both impeached, because I always do this. So I sit down and go, okay, so let me get this straight. Somewhere in Libya, Abdul and Abdullah, they're sitting at home. They're watching cat videos, smoking hookah, because that's what they like to do. They're just having a good time. And they're both law-abiding citizens. One's an accountant. Another one is an advertising executive. And oh my God, they see a video. They see a video of Muhammad. And before, they were just looking for cat videos, but they see this video of Muhammad, and it upsets them. And they're like, I'm a law-abiding citizen. I've never done anything wrong in my life, but today I'm going to drive to a consulate. Maybe I should call up some of my friends. Maybe I'll call, hey, you know what? Did you see this video? Oh, yeah, I saw the video. It's amazing, isn't it? You know what? I am actually a very nice person. I was just teaching my child how to play the piano. But you know what? I just found this cache of automatic weapons. Do you have a pickup truck? Yeah, I have a pickup truck. Should we get all the automatic weapons in the pickup truck and just drive to, where do you want to go? What, I hear there's a consulate in Benghazi. Do you know where that is? I happen to have the directions. I know exactly where it is. Let's go. Oh, and you know what? I've never broken the law in my life. I'm going to drag out a man and kill him and three other people. I'm going to do that. And then get this. When I'm done, I'm going to return to my life as a law-abiding citizen. I'm going to go back to teaching piano lessons and doing your taxes, because this was just some anomaly caused by a video. And what a coincidence. This weird reaction that I had happened on the anniversary of 9/11. That's what happens when you connect every dot. Once you connect every dot, you see how absurd every single idea they have is.
That's a great story, by the way, isn't it? Isn't that terrific? Talk about Greg Gutfeld, morality, because morality is a big issue in the book. It's kind of a big theme. And I think you basically summarize it by liberals always think they're right.
Right.
Right. They always think they're right. Not right in the sense of the political spectrum, but they believe they have morality on their side.
Exactly. So and because of that, if you disagree with them, then you are naturally evil. So the fact is, if they are adamant that climate change is the number one threat in the world, and you disagree, you are a climate denier. You're not in disagreement with them. You are a climate denier. They use that phrase denier because what's that linked to? Holocaust denial. So what they're saying is you are as bad as a Nazi. That's how it works. When I used to do Red Eye, I used to end all of my monologues with, if you disagree with me, you, sir, are worse than Hitler. And that was, it was just a mockery on the entire kind of rhetoric of the left, is that if you disagree with me, you are worse than evil. And you always have to respond with that with humor and just go, yeah, so what? So that was Andrew Breitbart's famous line on Red Eye when he was on. It was like somebody would say something to him and he'd go, so? That was it. He'd just say, so? And the person would be, but, no, so, really. So explain yourself. The best way to get them to lose is to have them explain themselves.
You know, I was reading today a great piece you wrote about Twitter. Mm. And Twitter's the worst.
Yes.
Anyone follow me on Twitter here? Please do. Thank you. But it's the worst. Mm-hmm. Social media may destroy society before it's over.
And besides, whatever happened to just following people on the street? Screw this following on Twitter. If you really care about somebody, especially somebody you don't know. Follow them. Follow them all day. Stand outside their house. Shout at them. Insult them. Because that's what Twitter is. Twitter has removed the intimacy of knowing somebody and has allowed and created this shield so you can say things. Very nice people. Very nice people. People who have lived on this planet for many, many years will say horrible things to you. And they don't understand that is wrong because they can't see you. And this whole thing, I call Twitter the bathroom wall of the world. Because, you know, remember, like, people don't even write on bathroom walls anymore. It's a shame.
Well, they're all unisex now, so yeah, it's very unisex. Awkward.
But that
know.
Should make the limericks even better. You know, here comes Jay. Never mind. Anyway, the point is that Twitter brings out the worst in people. And I was just talking about this with my manager on the way over here. Somebody should start up a Twitter in which you join, but it has to be your name. It has to be you. And that way, when you tie your name to something you say, it has more value than somebody under a pseudonym or a moniker, an avatar that is bogus. But I go through that. There's so many things that happen on Twitter that make me laugh. My favorite tweet is always the one that happens after a major tragedy or crime. So it's how people tie themselves into things in which they shouldn't. So there will be a massive terrorist attack in Paris, 120, 130 people dead, and someone will write, "Paris, I was just there 3 years ago." It's like Scott Whelan dies in his sleep, which is like an old-fashioned way of saying we don't know how. But it's like, and then somebody writes, "Oh, saw the Stone Temple Pilots in 92. Scott looked at me." It's like everybody, so it brings out the worst. It brings out the need to be noticed. The other thing, too, is that people like to out-compassion you. So after a shooting, you will have somebody go like, you know, "Damn you to hell, NRA. May you rot for killing these children." They don't really mean that. What they're saying is, "I care more than you," because they're obviously wrong. The NRA didn't go in there and commit that act, but they want they want to be seen as more compassionate than you do. And it's about building yourself up. I think it's one of the worst things, and I hate it because I love it.
I know. It's a guilty pleasure.
It's worse than a guilty pleasure. It's like a guilty torture. It's like you're walking in to be tortured.
Yeah.
You know? I was just looking at I'm not going to keep going on this because there are better questions.
All I got. No, but one of the things that I realize is that everybody's offended.
Yeah.
Everybody's offended today. You're offended, right? By something tonight, I hope. Right, and we're all offended, and now if you're not offended, it's almost as if you're heartless and you don't care.
Yeah.
You know, why are you not offended by that? It must be because you just don't have a heart. Mm-hmm. So people join in their offense and their outrage.
Yeah, it's about if you remove the barrier of entry to any kind of, like, strong commentary, there's just more strong commentary. And I wrote a book called Joy of Hate, which was basically which kind of predicted what we see now, which is that it's really easy to demand apologies and to get people to resign. It's very easy to go after a professor because his wife complained about Halloween costumes, he complained about Halloween costumes, and they went after her. When you remove that barrier and you allow people to become animals, what we're seeing on campuses is really the glorification of the mob. And the mob can go after you if they deem what you did offensive. And so what is offensive? It's not any kind of physical act anymore. It's actually words. They believe that words actually hurt. Even better, facts hurt. Gavin McInnes coined this phrase. He was a guest a lot on Red Eye. He calls them hate facts. They're facts you hate because they're true. And they're almost any time that you're in a situation where you talk about academia or media or even issues like climate change or identity politics, and you bring up a fact, it's amazing what happens. It's just like they just try to dismiss it because they're not used to seeing a fact. It's like a purple unicorn. It's like, what do I do with this? And then they get very angry.
How did you make the transition from being a magazine guy to going into television?
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about the other transition.
The one you're undergoing tonight after the event.
The hormones are a bit rough, but
Georgine.
Yes, going from a magazine editor. So the good thing about getting into TV when I was 43, 40. What am I now? I don't know.
72.
Yes, but was that I had no nobody knew me. So that was great. So I have no real, like, TV ego. The people that are usually my age that have been in it a long time are very, like, they live for TV. But it wasn't my life. I was a writer. I mean, I've always been a writer, and I always will be a writer. But the transition from magazines to this was not that hard, because I realized that my magazine meetings, the things that I was having every Monday, was a TV show. I'd sit there with my editors, and I would ask them what stories they have, and then I would yell at them. Which is exactly what I do on The Five. I realized I was training in private to do TV. I had no clue. But the other interesting thing about that, I guess, is that I didn't choose my career path. I don't even know if there's such thing as a career path, because I kind of wanted to do this for a living, and I ended up doing it for a living, but I didn't consciously choose it. I mean, this is what I do for a living right now is absolutely no different than what I did in Homeroom at Sarah High School, which was sit in the back and just go, that's stupid. And I mean, I had a lot to make fun of, but it's like, it's weird, because I didn't like, go, okay, I want to be a TV person. I want to be on a talk show where I'm paid to spout opinions and make fun of people. I mean, how there's nothing better. That's better than being a motion picture actor. Because you sit in a trailer and you read other people's lines. I get to go out there and I get paid to say things that I want to say. It's like this. It's the greatest thing ever.
Yes.
And it's what I wanted to do. But I guess my advice is, and to all the young people out here, which are none.
there's one in the front row there. I see
the one with the walker. I'm kidding. I make these jokes because you make these jokes. Anyway, the fact is, you will end up where you are as long as you keep working. If you keep taking jobs, in a weird way, the events find you and you don't find the events. And you will get, young people tend to get frustrated. They're not where they want to be, but it's like, you don't even know. It's all going to happen if you just shut up and you work. Develop a discipline, and it's all about working whether it feels good or not, and then everything happens. It always does, unless you get into like really bad drugs or awful relationships or both, which I did from about 2000 to 2000.
But you're married now.
Yes, I am.
Happily?
Of course.
Okay.
What a weird question. And what a weird place to divulge that you aren't. I'm so glad I've been waiting for somebody to ask me that question. Let me tell you, it's been really hard.
This is a safe space.
Yes, it's that. This isn't being recorded. Yes, it's been great. I recommend marriage to everybody.
You do?
Yes. You need a team. You got to have a team. You know, it's important to have somebody who supports you and you support them. Also, there's every guy knows this. The grass is always greener, no matter what you do. So when you're single and you're dating, you're going like, can't I just find one normal girl? Can't I just please? They're all crazy, especially in New York. Then you get married and you're walking to work and you go, wow, look at all these women. But it's a brain malfunction. It's actually a brain malfunction. When a man is walking to work, he actually thinks that when he sees these women, these are opportunities. He's not actually factoring in the time and effort that one must put into every stranger that you see. It's not like, oh, once you get divorced, all of these women are yours. No, they won't. They don't even see you. So anyway, it's a good thing.
You talk about contrast in the book. Contrast on political positions, for example. Pro-life, but pro-gay marriage, mm-hmm. Kind of libertarian, conservative on some things.
Yeah.
Where does that come from for you?
I'm not a big fan of team sport politics. And I came to that probably later when I noticed that I started to be around more of them. That's why I became a conservative. Was when I was at Berkeley, I was around liberals. And liberals follow a very strict litmus test. You have to agree on every single thing or you're out. And then when I became a conservative, I became that kind of conservative, because when you become a conservative, when you're a newbie, you become ideologically pure because it feels so good. It feels so good to be, I'm more conservative than you are. And this is why it drives me crazy to see the splintering in the Republican Party. It really bugs me when people call other people rhinos because we're just shifting. We're constantly shifting the purity test. Like if I happen to be for gay marriage, I'm a rhino. No, I'm like, we agree on 98%. And there might be something that I think you're more less conservative than I am. I think it's a real mistake. I think ideology often clouds truth. It makes you like people you shouldn't like, and it makes you dislike people that you should like. For example, you know, I never was a fan of Christopher Hitchens. You know, he was an atheist. He was a hardcore left winger. When I was in the 80s, I remember him. I think he was at The Nation. And then I started reading him and his. I urge everybody to read his stuff on Islam. And you know, he was a very big supporter of the Iraq War. And you find out that the most interesting people are the people that you cannot predict. They may be for this, they may be for not for that. But if you get along with them, you can talk about it. I mean, I have friends of mine, conservatives, who believe more strongly in global warming than I do. But I want to listen. I want to be proved wrong. And then I know liberals who are strong in me on gun rights. You know, look, Bernie Sanders, he likes guns. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
But he doesn't want to make them free like college, though.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah,
so
that would be great. Free guns. I'm gonna do that as a monologue. Bernie, you haven't gotten far enough. College and guns.
Just make sure you credit it, all right?
Yes. What's your name again? I'll just call you Orange Mike. From now on, his nickname is Orange Mike. Is your name Mike? No, I just had an orange microphone for one night.
Better than pink, though.
Yes. I don't know. What's wrong with pink? What's
no,
your
nothing,
problem?
Nothing. Nothing at all. Where do you think a lot of the, right now in this presidential primary process that we're in, there's a lot of anger Republicans show each other.
Right.
Particularly Donald Trump supporters and non-Donald Trump supporters.
Yes. I could go any different way with this. I say this in my book.
You go both ways?
Yes, I do.
On this?
Why limit it to two? I'm an adventurous guy. I'm staying at the Econo Lodge later, and it's just a small.
Just throw it out there.
It's a small get together. Don't bring anything with identification in case anything were to happen. I don't want anybody to be identified. Okay. I have a problem with the way things are going in the Republican thing because I hate emotion. It's the whole reason why I'm not a liberal is I hate all emotion. I don't think any decisions should be made on emotion because they're never right. Even love should not be made on emotion. So we conservatives have always prided ourselves on using our brains more than our hearts, and now we're angry. But anger is no different than any other emotion. So you need to keep that in check. You need to think, okay, I'm angry, but is this right? Is this right? And I do notice hypocrisy among people who really, really like a candidate because he fights, you know? And then if you criticize him, their skin is thinner than anything I've ever seen. You say, you know what, I think like personally, you know, I was really like I know Donald. He's a friend of mine. Donald would call me up after Red Eye and tell me how much he loved the show. I've flown on his jet. He's a sweetheart. But I got really upset at him about the McCain stuff because I'm sorry, you don't joke about that stuff. That guy was a POW who wouldn't allow himself to leave. And I think I don't care if you think he's a rhino. That doesn't matter. That's a political team sport idea. I'm talking about a human being who made a decision that made his life suffer, and I thought that Donald made a mistake with that. I don't think making fun of a woman's face is particularly graceful. A lot of people disagree with me about the disabled controversy of whether he meant to do that or not, but he did know the guy. But the reason why I bring this up is I've called him out on each one of these every single time, and I do it because I like him. And I call it the guardrails of criticism, that if you really, really like somebody, you have to criticize them or they don't get any better. I don't like minions. I don't like groupies. And I find it really, I don't like people who are, I'm for this person, I don't care what they do. I don't think that's healthy. That's an ideological team sport kind of mentality. And it doesn't give you the best candidate. That candidate will lose. The candidate that you really want you really want to help. And I think even Donald last night admitted it on Jimmy Kimmel when he said, yeah, I think I've been pretty divisive. You know, he's saying, you know, maybe I have been kind of a jerk.
But his people have gone after you.
Oh, of course.
On Twitter.
Yeah, but you know what? Again, going like people going after you on Twitter is, again, like somebody writing a picture of you on a bathroom wall. It's your fault if you care, you know?
Do you, you went to Berkeley, and that was where the free speech revolution happened.
I'd like to say I started it, yes.
You did start that. It was 1960
when
you were there?
Yeah, I was 4 years old. I said poo-poo and caca, and I got a Nobel Prize. When I said pee-pee, I got the Pulitzer. But anyway, is it Pulitzer or Pulitzer? I never know. Question.
You have to win it first, then they tell you.
Yes.
So good luck with that.
Thank you.
No, but the question is, does it scare you what's happening now at places like Berkeley?
I think it's great because you're seeing the end product. You're seeing the end product of 4 decades of PC thinking, of the professors winning and indoctrinating students. And you know when you see a pendulum go that far, it's going to swing back harder than ever. And you're watching comedians like Louis C.K. and Patton Oswalt and Jerry Seinfeld, who, by the way, I mean, to me, it's, you know, it's about time that and Chris Rock, that these guys actually came out and said something, because this is what they do for a living. Now they're just saying, oh, I'm not going to go on a campus anymore. But I posited an idea called speech easies. I think it was about 6 months ago. And it was the idea that, you know, in the old days when the prohibition was around, you had speakeasies, you know, people that drank, you know, in a basement bar. And I said, you know what? Young Republicans, I don't care who you are, you should start up a speakeasy, which is an area that you go in on campus and anything goes. And you sign a thing, all the cell phones go into a basket. There's no cell phones. You have 3 topics. You could talk about anything. I guarantee you, if this thing started, it would be massive. But I am too lazy to help start it. But I keep talking about it, hoping that there'd be some kid that go, I'm going to do this. But so far, it hasn't reached that critical mass yet. But you're watching it now. I mean, you're slowly watching these. Like what happened in Missouri. I mean, people cry, these safe spaces.
Yeah.
There's no safe space in life. There's none. They're setting themselves up for failure. If you live in a safe space on campus, good luck at your job interview, because they're not going to ask you safe questions. You loser. Seriously.
Delicate little snowflake.
Yes. Yes.
But it also seems like today we played a clip on the show where these Yale students, you probably heard about this video, it's going out there that they made, going up to Yale students.
First Amendment.
Would you sign a petition to ban the First Amendment? And this is a recurring theme now. Yeah. If I hear something that hurts my ears, then that's offensive speech, and offensive speech should not be protected speech.
And they're also not thoughtful. These students are not actually thinking about what is. It plays upon your need to belong. So if somebody comes up with a petition, that sounds nice, and they don't even think about it. So that's part of it, is that students are oddly too nice and then too emotional about their own feelings. I'm confident that it cannot last forever. Much like you, you cannot last forever.
Well, I would hope not. I hope this night does not last forever. You don't even know my name. You've only been on my show twice.
You're Orange, you know. Mike. They called him Orange Mike.
Who's been your favorite guest on The Five, or on your show, Red Eye, or The Five?
Ooh, that's tough. I didn't expect to see that question.
And after you invite me, I will be.
Yes.
The answer is Rich Zeoli. Yes. After you invite me, but up till now.
Who is? You know what my favorite show was, when I had Bob Beckel and his brother Graham on at the same time, and to watch the family rivalries and bitterness bubble up. And to the point where, like, Bob is like this. And like, he's being reminded of something horrible. And Graham, who's a conservative and a great actor, I don't know if you ever remember L.A. Confidential.
Yeah.
He played Stanzel, the guy with the, he always had a ball in his pocket. He was a bad man. Graham's a great actor. But having them together was amazing. In terms of, I love music, so Johnny Rotten, when I had him on from the Sex Pistols, and I've had him on like maybe 4 or 5 times. I love the Sex Pistols. When I had Mick Jones from The Clash was my favorite band growing up. So having him on with Tony James from Generation X, that was awesome. So I like music. Andrew W.K., I like musicians. King Buzzo from the Melvins. I like having smart musicians on, because that's surprising, because a lot of musicians, they're not, it's not that they're not smart, they just don't use that part of their brain.
Right. How about comedians?
Comedians.
Are they annoying guests sometimes because they're always trying to be funny?
Some do, some don't. If somebody comes trying to do shtick, it will destroy the conversation. I had that with one comedian who goes by one name, and he...
Sinbad?
No, but close.
Okay.
Everybody thinks it's Sinbad. But it was embarrassing. I had a guy that showed up really, really drunk, and we couldn't air that. What was his name? He was in Dazed and Confused. But anyway... comedians that I like are the ones that are that can play in a conversation, that they're the same person on stage that they are. So Jim Norton is one of them. He just doesn't change his tone. He doesn't have written jokes. He doesn't have any notes.
Right.
He's just there as a friend to talk, and I like that a lot. I'm trying to remember other comedians. There's a lot of them.
How about athletes? Because you talk about sports in the book a little bit.
Do I?
Probably.
I'm gonna have to ask my ghostwriter.
I didn't read it, but
that's a great thing. You'll never accuse me of ghostwriting, because you read that and you go, only that could come from there. But sports. Look, I'm from Sarah High School, so sports. You know, obviously the home of Barry Bonds and Tom Brady and Lynn Swan. So I just like to throw that out there for no reason. I don't have a lot of athletes on. The only athlete I have on that's great is Boomer Esiason. He's funny, and he's quick-witted, and he's a good right winger.
Yeah.
Though he hides it.
But you have a way of getting it out of him, though, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, he's a big Five fan. That's how I found out.
Do you think more people are conservative than the nation thinks?
Absolutely.
The media would have us believe that everybody's really a liberal and that the conservatives were the minority.
Yes, it's a thing, because as an America, we don't pay attention to politics the way media, academia, and government does. And because they pay attention to it, they tend that garden, and they're overwhelmingly liberal. So those things, the things that you get fed every day, started in this. I noticed in the 70s, I'm 51. I know I look like 40. but that was when sitcoms started inserting messages into the plots. And I remember that going like, wow, I'm being told something. Like, what are they telling me? Like there was an episode where Janie brings home a homeless man for Thanksgiving. It's like, and he turns out, you know, he's like such a sweet guy down on his luck. But if you actually did that in New York, the homeless man would defecate on your living room floor. He would masturbate in your kitchen. He would try to drink every single medical prescription in your pharmacy, and then he would try to knife somebody, and then he'd run away. But that's the thing is, reality, fantasy, television is taken over by fantasy, these fantasy ideas. And if you point it out, if you point out the reality, you are evil.
Right.
And so that they own that turf, because we don't care. Our turf has always been other things. Family, sports, stuff, but you don't like, you don't, I know, I mean, it's like, you know, Fox News, before Fox, I mean, where did, I don't know where people went before Fox News, other than talk radio, for an other point of view. I don't know, because you didn't have it, you know?
I didn't even know there was another point of view.
Yeah, well, that was the interesting thing, that this woman who's interrupting. you can have her taken out here. No, but that's an interesting point. When I was at Berkeley, so I was a liberal at high school. I worked for extra credit, I worked on the nuclear freeze, just getting signatures for that. I was a lefty because I never heard of another side. And when I got to Berkeley and I was surrounded by hard left, like you wouldn't believe. Like everywhere you went, there was somebody yelling at you on the street. But this guy, Patrick Fleischer, came in one day to the fraternity with this oversized magazine called The American Spectator, never seen it before, and National Review. And because his dad was a conservative. And I didn't even know, I never even heard, I was like probably 17 or 18, I never even heard of like conservatives, what that was. I didn't know what, and I remember I don't know why, I started looking at the American Spectator and I go, this is really funny and weird. At PJ O'Rourke and Tom Wolfe and all these, Andy Ferguson and all these great writers. And then I started reading that middle section of National Review called This Week, which were like little blocks. Some of it was written by William F. Buckley and other people, and it was like, this is funny. And then I found like P.J. O'Rourke's books, because I'd read P.J. O'Rourke when he edited National Lampoon, And then I read his Republican Party reptile, and I went, my God, this is like a whole world that I didn't know existed, and I became a conservative in short time because I found the other path, the path that nobody even knows exists.
Do you still like National Review now?
Yes, I like NRO. I like the online. I like the guy. I like. I really like Kevin Williamson's writing. Smart as hell. He just wrote a book against Trump, a little screed. But he is a tremendous writer. And I like, you know, I like what's his face, Rich Lowry, and Charles Cook, and Jonah Goldberg. They're all really great writers.
Now, while you take your sip of water and take your time with that. Donald Trump yesterday was bashing a bunch of your colleagues.
Of course he does, yes.
Krauthammer, George Will called him an idiot with little glasses.
Yes, that was an intelligent comment.
He went after, I think he went after, well, name a person on Fox who's not named Hannity.
Everybody.
And he probably went after that person.
He doesn't go after me.
He doesn't, well, he likes you.
Yeah, yeah.
Or he just doesn't know who you are. It's
Believe me, we know each other. And actually,
you were on his plane. You just told us that.
I genuinely like him, and I don't understand that part of him.
Yeah.
I don't get it. Like, for example, he goes after Jonah Goldberg. Jonah Goldberg wrote Liberal Fascism. So when Donald Trump says, you know, we have to react against the politically correct. Well, Jonah Goldberg wrote one of the great books on that called Liberal Fascism. And he says, you know, it's time to, you know, say shut up to PC talk. And I go, well, Charles Krauthammer has written a lot on that. So all these guys that you're kind of going after were there first. And he doesn't know that because, in my perspective, Donald is a newbie. He came to this late. He came to the forwarded emails from your uncle late. You know, is this true? I'm not saying it's false, but this could be true. And it's like it's a picture of President Obama in a dress. It's obviously been photoshopped. But everybody has an aunt who forwards that stuff. It's a newbie conservative kind of thing. And I think when you're like that, you don't read up on the you don't read up on the history, so you don't realize that, like, you know, these guys you're going after, they kind of paved the way for you. They paved the way. I mean, whether it's Rich or it's Jonah, these guys were there first. And because you don't know them, but you've identified the same kind of problem, but it's new to you, and then it's also new to your fans, who then gang up on these people. I think it's not presidential. Is the way I would put it.
Do you? You're obviously a very funny guy.
Oh, thank
and
you.
You're welcome. And handsome.
Just very.
Where
I wouldn't
go
handsome. I'd go striking, maybe.
Dashing. Where does your humor come from for you? Is it something you've always been funny? Class clown.
I was the class clown, but it wasn't until later because a lot of this stuff happened because of my mother. You know, most kids are shy until they aren't. And what does that mean? They do studies. They find that if parents are kind of shy, and you're shy, you're going to be shy. But if your parents actually try to get the kid out, you can get that kid out and active in something. And that's what my mother did. I mean, I was a pretty shy kid. And then, you know, my mother bought me Mad Magazine when I was home sick one day. And I opened that. And that was like a universe. It's like, where did this come from? There's no advertisements. There's no adults. And then she went on and she bought me National Lampoon, which she didn't realize had a lot of nudity in it. If you remember, in the 70s, the photo funnies were just PJ O'Rourke's excuse to get women topless in the office. But it was like, and all of a sudden I started doing things that a 10-year-old does, not that, but crank calls. Nobody does crank calls anymore because you can't crank call people who know you on your phone. But that's all I did. Like at 3 o'clock, you get home from school, I would get the tape recorder, I would tape record the toilet flushing, and then I would call and I'd play it, and it would be, and then I was constantly crank calling. And that's a thing that a kid does when he's been turned on to fun, funny things. I guarantee you, if you look at anybody who works in kind of the vein of humor or whatever, they probably were an avid crank caller, because that's the first thing. It's like, I can do this, you know. And then that went away. But the upside of that going away, having three older sisters, the other thing that went away was obscene phone calls. Nobody gets obscene phone calls anymore, because like you know, they know who you are.
Right.
But it was great because as I had, you know, I had three older sisters, so when I would pick up the phone and there'd be this heavy breathing, I just assumed that they had asthma. You know, I had no idea what was going on. I go, I think it's for you, Les. He's breathing heavily. He's not well. But no, so it came. I think it came from my mom finding out that kicking me in a little direction, and then all of a sudden I was watching Monty Python, and then Fernwood Tonight, and America Tonight, and right. And just I just started that. That's what happened, and then you know, if my mom hadn't done that, you know, that's why I always dedicate my books to her, because, you know,
that's very sweet.
Wouldn't it be great if she was, you know, she's alive or somewhere, and she's going, I never liked him.
Yeah.
he's full of shit.
I disowned him when he was two. But humor is such a theme in your book, and how to use humor to win arguments, to win people your way of thinking.
Yeah. It's better to be, to fight with a smile. You know, I said this before, that what kills the left is that they were so shrill. And maybe before the left, the right was shrill. And it keeps going back and forth. We can adopt, there's a whole chapter in this book on adopting the left strategies, but one of them you don't want to adopt is being shrill or angry. You can have fun. You arm yourself with a few facts, and you smile, and you go, and you say, what do you think, or so, and you have to be the one who's having more fun than they are.
Right.
Because once you forfeit that turf, you always lose. I have to go do a show in a couple of weeks. That is a show that Fox News people don't normally do. And I think, you know, okay, how do I prepare? And I go, I already know what to do. You have to have more fun than that person.
Is it Bill Maher?
No, I'm not going to say.
Okay.
You'll be surprised. But he's the Weather Channel. Something new for me.
But he's a guy who's crossed the left a lot on the Muslim issue, for example.
Well, that goes back to, yeah, there are times I hate Bill Maher.
Yeah.
Like, I can't stand his smarminess. And then all of a sudden he'll do something that I go, I love Bill Maher. And I love it when he turns on his audience, because it's such a refreshing thing when he goes, why are you clapping at that? It's like, why are you clapping? You're just clapping because you agree. That's not funny. And he gets really mad. One of the great Bill Maher moments, and you can find it on YouTube, is when Christopher Hitchens was on to defend the Iraq War. And when the audience, he said something and the audience booed him, and he just stood up and he gave him two fingers. And I never saw that on TV. And I thought, yes, I like this atheist socialist for doing that. And but like, you know, Maher is now kind of like the leading voice on radical Islam, on the threat of Islamism, on what's going on campuses, because maybe he's just getting sick of the people he's being around. I mean, there was nothing better. I mean, the best Bill Maher episode was the one when Ben Affleck was on, and Sam Harris, who's an atheist, who's also a critic of Islamism, and it was great. The angriest person in the room was the superstar, Ben Affleck, the guy who has everything. And Sam Harris and Bill Maher just talking about Islam, radical Islam, and Ben Affleck calling him bigots, and he's sweating. He's got sweat dripping on his face. And it was one of the best. If you haven't seen that, go on YouTube, put in Affleck, Maher, and it's amazing how angry. Affleck calls him a bigot.
Right.
Calls him a racist. He goes, Sam Harris goes, you know, I think he said, radical Islam is the mother load of bad ideas. And Affleck says, that's racist. And it's like, you can't get, it's not, you know, it's you can't be racist against a set of ideas. You can't be racist if you don't like Islam or if you don't like Christians, because it's not a race. It's a set of ideas. And it was like, it was just a beautiful way of exposing this kind of bizarre, myopic, hyper-tolerant view, where if you disagree, you're racist. And that kills people. It really does.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like that. It's like the neighbors didn't say anything about the San Bernardino people because they were afraid of being called out. And then today, President Obama says, you know, if you see something, say something. But, you know, no backlash. You know, we got to remember. We got to be not. And it's like, it's like there's this weird thing saying, you know, if you see something, say something, but don't really say anything, because I'm going to call you a bigot.
And then the attorney general will investigate you.
Yes.
And prosecute you.
Yes. I know.
For
Loretta.
Speech.
Yes. That was the first thing.
A couple questions from the audience.
Yes.
See, Mark C. asks, how can I use your How to Be Right principles and your wit to explain to a liberal how the human race was created?
Mm-hmm. Well, you mean like sex? I don't think you need my book for that.
That's a different book.
I could recommend some movies. I'm not sure what he means. I don't understand that question. Could you like the beginning, the origins of humanity, the origins of the earth, evolution. I believe in evolution. I don't know. Is that like, you know, maybe he doesn't believe in evolution and he thinks that it's,
by the way,
Adam
back to
Eve.
Back to Ben Affleck for a second.
Sure.
He's going to ruin Batman.
Yes. Yes.
I just had to get that off my chest.
I agree.
He's going to ruin it.
I agree.
He's awful. I hate him.
I think that's the most important point that's made tonight.
Thank you very much.
If there's something that you go home with, it's like Ben Affleck is going to ruin Batman.
This is from another Mark. Mark O. What can today's Republican Party learn from the wit and wisdom of President Reagan?
I think you have to think before you speak, and I always felt like he was pretty good at that. And also, he was charming. He was affable. He was likable. He might not have been like that behind the scenes, but he surely projected that. I don't think, a lot of people say that Donald Trump is Reagan-esque. I don't see that yet. I don't.
Do you see that in anybody running for president now?
I see glimpses of things. I see forceful eloquence in Christie. When he talks, I meet these guys because they come and do the five. And when Christie talked to me, I felt like he was looking right at me. And he was like, I mean, I felt like what he was telling me was the absolute truth. What he believed, that he didn't care if I disagreed. And I felt like this wasn't a politician. This was just he was a prosecutor. He reminded me of Kimberly. When Kimberly starts getting mad at you, you see the prosecutor. You're like, oh, geez. I think Rubio, he's articulate. I think he's thoughtful. He can cogently describe an issue. I think Trump is funny. At times he's funny, but he crosses a line. I realize Trump's strategy is to drop a bomb and then modify the bomb. So you say the thing, ban all Muslims, and then you start modifying. Well, I didn't really say all. Just the ones we don't like.
Not my friends.
Yeah, not my friends. I got a lot of Muslim friends. And you know what? They agree with me. Muslims are bad. All my Muslim friends are saying, yeah, we're bad. We're after you. I would have loved to have heard that discussion. But I mean, like, the line that he did on the very first debate about Rosie O'Donnell was so perfectly timed. And I go, wow, that was, you know, it's like, are you, you say these things about women, blah, blah, blah. And he goes, no, it was just Rosie O'Donnell. I don't think you could have come up with a better answer than that. But then he'll, like, you know what, I think what happens is, I'll stop because I talk a lot about Trump, but there's a couple of things. One, he's like a traveling comic that got used to the laughter. And so he doesn't know when to stop. And so he'll, like, that's when he gets into trouble, when he talks about Carly's face or does an impression of a reporter. It's because he gets comfortable and he doesn't know when to pull the hook on himself. I also liken him to like a classic rock band. That's traveling the fairgrounds, and they have like three classic hits. So like Immigration is his free bird. What do you want to hear? Immigration, and everybody goes, yeah. Coming up, China. That would be his Stairway to Heaven. And Muslims is his, now probably is My Sharona, but it's like he has this or My Sharia. I gotta remember that one. It was off the top of my head. It's not bad. Sometimes I even surprise myself. But you know what I mean? So what happens is, he's traveling. People are going to see him like they're going to see Lynyrd Skynyrd. Or they're going to see a newly reformed quasi-version of Led Zeppelin. And he shows up, and they know what he's going to do. And I've watched the audience, because he'll talk for a long time. And some of them are fidgeting, and they're not listening. But they're there, because it's like, I went and did this. And that's exciting to them. And that is different, because you don't see that. And I'm saying this as somebody who is, you know, strongly disagrees with him on a lot of stuff. But going back into another point, I could talk 2 hours on this guy. You know what's interesting about him? And it's the positive and the negative of Trump. It's the reason why Rush Limbaugh was mad at him about going after Cruz was because that showed a glimpse that Trump may not be as ideologically conservative, and we know that already, as he pretends to be. He will be, when he becomes president, if he becomes president or whatever, a lot of these things that he talks about will not happen because he's changes his mind. And he's not an ideologue. He is not a dyed-in-the-wool conservative yet. Or I mean, you know that he can just change his mind. And I think that's what that's what Rush was hinting at. I think that's a plus, but I also think it's a minus. The minus is you don't know if he's telling the truth. You don't know if he really believes what he believes. But then you say, well, maybe he's saying that just to win. And maybe that's not such a bad idea. But then the bad thing is, can he win? Does this alienate a lot of people? But then the other says, well, who cares? He fights. But maybe when he fights, people say he's fighting the wrong people. This could go on forever.
Why does Jeb suck so bad? And I don't know how else to put that question.
Because, believe it or not, we've a couple of things. Because he's a good man, he doesn't fight. He gets very uncomfortable when he has to fight. Since he lost that weight, the weird posture of his arms bothers me. He has Kareem Abdul-Jabbar arms on my body. But anyway, that's a small thing. But he's not used to this. And I think we've moved a goalpost on what's conservative. I mean, he was really one of the most conservative governors in Florida. I mean, he was very, I know people don't like, Common Core. But he was really strong on school choice. You can't have everything. And he did a lot of other things in Florida that was good that I can't name because, frankly, I stopped reading. But we've moved the goalposts on him. And he's easy to make fun of. Like, the brilliance of Trump is the, you know, he finds a word and he goes, low energy, and then you can't get that. It's like, you can't get that off you. What's with Jeb? He's so low energy. What is with this guy? What is with this guy? This guy. I don't get it. Cruz is a maniac. No. And then he always does this thing. No. Don't get me wrong. He's a great guy. I like him. He's a great guy. He's a great guy. But, you know, he's a maniac. A great maniac.
But if Trump becomes the nominee of the Republican Party and then he's running against Hillary Clinton in a general election, that will be, if nothing else, very entertaining.
It will be very entertaining. But, I you know, it's interesting. Half of me thinks he will lose big because of the building of the wall and that sort of thing. He's going to lose from a coalition of voters who will just run from him. He'll get fewer Hispanic voters than Romney did. He'll have fewer women than any Republican. I mean, according to the stats now, it looks like he would lose badly. However, at the same time, he kind of operates in a bubble of immunity that he can say and do whatever he wants, and people accept that, and that's kind of refreshing. And maybe that, I mean, remember, President Obama operated in a bubble of immunity. He was the first African-American president, and he was going to win no matter what because voters felt good voting for him. They didn't care about any of his issues or lack of experience. I knew this. I talked to friends that they wanted to be part of history, so they voted for him because they didn't want to be the person that didn't vote for him. So that's why they did it. In this case, that could happen with Trump because he's so immune to anything that he says that he could actually, people can go, you know what? I like this guy because he says whatever he wants, and you know what? I don't care if he pisses people off. Maybe I like that. So I don't know, but I would be pessimistic. I think Hillary's got a lot of the segments already locked up. And so I think Rubio might have a better chance.
Do you think Hillary is a lock at this point, or do you think she might get indicted?
She might be locked up. Am I right, America? Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. It's like, who else
you don't
got?
See Bernie coming to the left? Because she lost in a primary once before by somebody going to her left.
Yeah, that's true. But I just don't see Bernie, you know. Bernie's...
you don't feel the burn,
I don't
Greg?
Feel the burn. Well, sometimes. Tetracycline. Actually, that's, boy, did I age myself. Nobody uses tetracycline anymore. It's more like the doxies.
What do you think when you look at the presidential field, though, and if they were going to ask you for your help in crafting their message? I mean, Republicans seem to lose a lot of these arguments, right, when it comes to the media.
Yeah.
What are they doing wrong?
Well, I think they have to go strong on the failure. Well, look, I've said this for the last, I don't know how long. National security is the only thing that, in my mind, matters. I said it on the five. If it's a skyscraper, it's the base. You pull that out, you don't have the economy. You don't have any economic inequality. You don't have your unisex bathrooms. You don't have your Native American headdresses that are offensive as Halloween costumes. You know, you don't have any things you can complain about. And so I think national security is playing to the Republicans, and the Republicans have to be incredibly articulate about it by stating the fear correctly, the concern correctly, and the specific solutions. I talk about this a lot. You know, terrorism has changed. We have married technology to evil. And now it doesn't take, you don't need a guy to come in with a gun and shoot up a bunch of people. We are going to look at that as the days when it was manageable. All it takes now is a drone and somebody getting some anthrax and doing it over a stadium, and that's it. Remember, the goal is apocalypse. They think they're doing you a favor by killing you, so the more the merrier. That needs to be articulated without it being, like, banning all Muslims is not the coherent way of doing that. You have to talk about radical Islam, what they are planning specifically to do, and it's not just shooting up community centers. It's much bigger than that. That has to be articulated because it puts the Democrats are on a back foot. They've said nothing. They're more interested in climate change. This micro increase hypothetically in Celsius, which may or may not be man-made, and these are things that they care about while people are dying. In real time, I think that you have to be the person that is most coherent on that should win. I think Rubio is really good on that. I think Christie's great on that. Carly is really good on it, but I don't think I just she's a woman. No, I'm kidding. No, she's not. I'm not a big Ben Carson, Carly Fiorina fan because they haven't been in an office, and I know that sounds very establishment, and I know that I don't hold that to Donald, but Donald is just an odd duck. Kind of transcends the kind of strictures you would place.
All right, let me give you a couple issues and tell us how we can say the issue and win. Climate change.
Climate change, say when. What do you mean?
How do I win an argument on climate change?
Say it's entirely possible that what you're saying is true, but according to the data, you have been wrong on everything, and then you can. This is why you have to look stuff up. You know, you have to look at the pause in temperatures. You also have to point out that the hottest year in record could be a percent of error, because it's so small, and that there have been times when it's been way, way warmer, well before SUVs. You should know about the mini ice age and the mini warm periods. You should have this in your belt, but you should also be open to being wrong. You say, it isn't entirely possible that it could be caused by coal, but now after you've used coal all this time, you want to keep it from the billion people who are not on the electrical grid, and this is really where the best argument comes from. It's like, so, in your warm dorm at Harvard, you want to ban coal. There are a billion people who are off the electrical grid, who 3 to 4 million die every year burning impure fuels like feces and trash in their house because they don't have cheap energy. Coal saves millions of lives, and maybe there might be some kind of hypothetical leak between CO2, man-made global warming, but I think we should explore it further before we take that away from millions and millions of poor people. And what that is you just out-compassioned the climate change people.
And our Western white male privilege, yeah, telling these poor nations they can't develop energy.
I call it ocean privilege, because because they say white male. I go, well, you have ocean privilege. you're separated by your ocean, so you don't care about terror. You don't care about energy or anything. You got it all here with your iPods.
Guns. How do we win an argument on guns?
I always use I use the phrase gun control. I use the phrase gun ceiling. That it's like, why. Why do you not want women to protect themselves? That's a gun ceiling. When you talk about limiting lawful ownership of guns, you're talking about, there are more women than there are men. Women have 55, 50%, less muscle mass than men. So when, and they're often the target of rape, you denying them the right to protect themselves is sexist, it's misogynist, it's grotesque. You can also point to, and the statistics show, an overwhelming number of shootings are at gun-free zones. We've heard that argument a lot. So I use that argument, but sometimes I move that argument into the sexist argument because it's new, no one's used it. The other argument is there's a great study, I think it was done by the FBI, in which they polled criminals and they asked them, how do you choose your targets? What are you most likely to choose? And lo and behold, get this, they are less likely to choose a target who might be armed. That fact explains every single crime on the planet, and it's lost because nobody connects the dots. They go gun-free zone, and they don't connect the dot. It's Aurora, you know. It's a theater. That guy researched theaters, and he found the theater that was in a gun-free zone. He skipped theaters that were closer to him for that reason. There's an interesting fact that I found out this weekend. I'm reading a book called Softening Hard Targets. It's about a retired Air Force general who, I didn't even know this, but Sandy Hook was not his intended target. He had driven to Newton High School first. Does anybody know this? I didn't know this, but this is footnoted in an academic book that this kid, Adam Lanza, drove to Newton High School, but drove past it because there was a parked police car there. There was nobody in it. But what the simple logic is, even the most minor deterrent, anybody who's a police officer knows this, when somebody has a problem, you say, I'll park my car out in front of your house. That was an old school thing they used to do in the 70s or 80s. They go, oh, you know what? Don't worry about it. Like, if Sandra's worried about an ex-boyfriend. You know, he's threatening her. He goes, you know what? I'll park my car out in front. That's what cops used to do. And that's, I mean, if, according to this book, which was written by a hardcore researcher, he drove to that other school because of an empty cop car. So deterrence, the threat of pain, the threat of being killed actually works. It's why guns are important and valuable.
No, that's great, but you got to have your facts, and then you got to figure out an emotional point too.
Yeah, it's facts plus heart, but never lead with your heart because then you become just like them. However, you can out compassionate them if you want because that might confuse them. But you should always have but the compassion should have a fact in it. Like telling them that, okay, how do you explain to a woman who has to walk home from her waitressing job at night, who has 50% less muscle mass, who has to walk home in a rough neighborhood that she can't protect herself? You gonna tell her to bring a rape whistle? Is that gonna be good enough? The best rape whistle is a handgun.
Well, listen, thanks so much for coming out tonight. We've enjoyed it very, very much.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
And what's your now? You work on another book?
Yes, it's called The Life and Times of Orange Mike.
It's going to be a national bestseller.
Yes, it will be. I've been thinking about a new book, and it probably is going to be about, I've written some stuff on Breitbart about your guide to apocalypse prevention, and it's about the idea of thinking about these threats in a way that you can act on it yourself because you can't rely on the government. I'm not talking about like moving into a silo and surrounding yourself with, you know,
canned William, food.
Yeah, and gold and silver catheters. it's just an idea. What can you do to make your life safer in a place where nobody really is doing it for you?
Greg Gutfeld, everybody, thank you so much. Fantastic.